AAA says gas averages $3.13 a gallon nationally. OPEC says, yeah, get used to that, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 6th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Our program begins on this Tuesday with yet another pandemic-induced video conference. Routine though they may be by now, this one could have ramifications for the entire global economy. OPEC Plus, which is the 13 core members of the cartel and 10 oil-producing but not quite in the club yet countries, had a tough weekend. Not only could they not come to terms on the aforementioned Zoom on higher production targets as demand heats up, they couldn't even agree on when to meet next, virtually or otherwise. So that took crude prices to seven-year highs at one point today, before closing down a tad, a bit more than $73 a barrel for the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate. Told you all that so we could tell you this. That $73 and change is way above break-even for most U.S. oil producers. And yet, American drillers aren't pumping anywhere near what they were just a couple of years ago. Now, I always thought when prices spike like this, it was drill, baby, drill, right? Marketplace's wildcatting correspondent Andy Euler sets me straight.
Okay, so turns out there's a lot that's holding American producers back. Ellen R. Wald, president of Transversal Consulting, says first and foremost is the idea of capital discipline.
Some of it is definitely due to this emphasis now on paying down debts, on return on investment, but also they're seeing a real reluctance among investors to shell out more money for new drilling.
She says many institutional investors got burned over the last decade when the attitude in energy was all about growth before prices tanked. That leads to the question Jesse Thompson at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas says producers are asking themselves before completing more wells.
Is this, you know, something that we're going to be able to raise investor capital to do?
Even if the cash is there, there are other factors at play as to why U.S. producers are reluctant. Oil companies have to consider the regulatory ambitions of the Biden administration, says Antoine Hauf, a founding partner at the energy consultancy Kairos, especially, he says, when it comes to the methane that leaks out of oil wells.
There's probably a concern among producers that they need to be very careful not to ramp up their methane emissions too much and to toe the line and to try to reduce their footprint as much as they can.
But come on, $75 a barrel? Michael Lynch, a fellow at the Energy Policy Research Foundation, says despite all of these issues, that's still a very tempting number for any oil company.
The industry tends to promise capital discipline and slowly drift into irrational exuberance. So if the price stays up long enough, you will see the financial taps open.
Give it a year, Lynch says, and reluctance to drill will be a thing of the past. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The high today in Los Angeles is a beautiful 82 degrees. Lows overnight in the 60s. A little more humid than usual, but still very nice outside. You just got that weather free of charge from your favorite public radio host, as you can get from your phone or Google or your local television news broadcast. But would you pay $5 a month for that? Maybe plus some other weather stuff? The investment group that owns the Weather Channel says it is going to be offering a streaming service, cleverly branded Weather Channel Plus, later this year. Also in the forecast, Fox Weather, a new 24/7 weather streaming platform courtesy of Rupert Murdoch. Of course, climate change is not only making weather predictions more volatile, they're making them more important to consumers and more valuable, thus, to businesses. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains that one.
Weather Channel Plus may sound like an SNL skit about how we've run out of ideas for streaming services, but there are a lot of Weather Channel nerds.
And so we had a dress-up day that was choose your, like, a TV day. And so, of course, I chose the Weather Channel because it's my favorite.
Kelly Neal wore a Weather Channel-themed costume at the nursing home she works at in Anderson, South Carolina. The Weather Channel is on a lot. And Neil watches it at home, too. She's constantly checking the app. Yeah, she'd consider a streaming service.
I love the Weather Channel personality people. Like, if they had Jim Cantore on the weather streaming, yeah, that'd be worth $5.
Weather has always been the most commercially valuable hour of the newscast. That's where the commercials cost more.
Marshall Shepard is a meteorologist at the University of Georgia and host of a Weather Channel podcast. He says extreme weather events, that brutal heat dome in the Pacific Northwest or more intense hurricane seasons, have made the five-day forecast even more compelling for the average viewer.
We're starting to see things that are getting people's attention. And so what's important about that is these things affect people's bottom lines, their kitchen table lives, their insurance rates.
Ed Maybach studies climate change communication at George Mason University. He's very interested in how the new Fox Weather Channel will cover those events.
If they're bringing us the facts and just the facts, meaning the science, could be a real service, a huge service, in fact.
Maybach's research suggests conservative-leaning voters are more likely to learn about climate change from local TV weather people than other outlets. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, make of this what you will. Jeff Bezos steps down as the CEO of Amazon. The stock promptly hits a record high. Actually, don't make anything of it. Correlation is not causation, right, gang? Now, the 10-year Treasury note? That's a whole different deal. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Chinese President Xi Jinping gave a big speech the other day. Last Thursday, July the 1st, was the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party. And Xi took the opportunity to say, among other things, that Beijing will never allow anyone to bully, oppress, or subjugate China. That's a quote from his speech. The Communist Party's been in control in China since 1949. Planned economy, five-year plans, and all the rest of that. But the economic influence that China now has dates to 1978 and a policy known as reform and opening up, or sometimes socialism with Chinese characteristics. So to get a sense of exactly how communist the world's second biggest economy might actually be right now, Marketplace's Jennifer Pack took a little road trip.
A punk band called Subs plays to hundreds of young people with black, pink, and purple hair. The fans jump about and bob their heads. This is the MIDI Festival. It's been going on for more than 20 years, making it the oldest rock music festival in China. Before that, the only way to listen to rock was to pick through trash, literally. Sub-singer Kang Mao says there was a black market of discarded, partially damaged cassette tapes from the West, known as cutouts. Cutout cassettes were exported to China as plastic for recycling. And to show that they were not for sale, there were holes in the cassettes, though some of the tapes could still be played if you glued them back together. Everything we knew about music back then was from the cassettes. The first album she bought, Bleach, by American rock band Nirvana. It set her on the path to be a musician, and that used to be a government job. But today, the private sector creates more employment and is bigger than the public sector, says Nicholas Lardy with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Private activity has steadily expanded over the last 40 or 50 years and now accounts for roughly somewhere between 2/3 and 4/5 of the economy.
Sub's guitarist Wu Hao grew up in the 1980s when the Communist Party tightly controlled everything from food rations and travel to jobs. To people like him, China today seems pretty capitalist.
From my vantage point, I can't see any traces of the planned economy today.
It may look that way because day-to-day, consumers deal more with private companies. That's different as you go further up the supply chain, says the chief economist of Hang Seng Bank in China, Wang Dan.
The state sector controls more of the upstream industries. When you look at natural resources, strategic sectors, aeronautics and astronautics, they are mostly state-owned.
As well as state-owned enterprises, there are also state-backed firms. When the Trump administration banned the sale of U.S. technology to Chinese businesses a couple of years ago, there were fears of a microchip shortage in China. So the government stepped in. Again, here's analyst Nicholas Lardy.
Most of the companies producing chips in China are actually private. And so the government is now channeling funds to these private companies in order to boost their capacity and to help them become more innovative.
Now, national governments own some companies in market economies, too. But in the West, there are nowhere near as many of these state-owned enterprises, or SOEs, as in China, says Andrew Batson with the consultancy Gavkell Dragonomics.
So the share of SOEs in China's GDP is, you know, double or triple what any Western nation has ever experienced.
These state-owned firms get credit more easily from the banks, but most analysts say they're less efficient. Still, efficiency and profits aren't everything. China's government also uses these public companies to help stabilize the economy in times of crisis. Like during the COVID-19 pandemic, state-owned factories were the first to resume work, says analyst Wang Dan.
That helped China to become really the manufacturing center very quickly when the rest of the world were in pretty much a very big recession.
Back at the MIDI Rock Festival, the punk band Subs bangs out another number. Some 20 police officers watch over the audience. The band says it's been told to talk less to the crowd between songs and to avoid anything political. But singer Kang Mao says censorship isn't the band's biggest problem. It's the music fans.
Art in China is seen as useless. Some fans grew up with us but left when they turned 30 because they needed to get married and raise children. They worried about how to get to work and find a place to live.
Things the Communist Party used to provide. Kang Mao says older fans now need to spend more on these necessities. They have less money to splash out on non-essential items, like live music shows. From Eastern Jiangsu Province, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I've had a really tough 2021.
Struggles are indeed far and wide. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 208 points today, 0.6%, closed at 34,577, did the blue chips. NASDAQ went the other way, up 24 points, about a 0.1%, 14,663. S&P 500 dipped 8 points, about 0.2%, 43.43 there. We heard from Mueller about the latest gyrations in the oil markets. So, Occidental Petroleum lost more than 6% today. ConocoPhillips down 3.9%. Rents are up 9.2% so far this year. That's according to recent data from ApartmentList.com. The company says in previous years, the growth nationally from January to June, more like 2-3%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down 1.35%. Quite a fall from the other day. Still, you know, ridiculously low, but going down more. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For those who worked yesterday so the rest of us could have the day off, thank you. Nothing like a short work week every now and then, right? Unless it's a short work week all the time. There's a study out of Iceland, a years-long experiment with shorter working hours that has just been published. Turns out productivity stayed steady and often got better when thousands of public sector workers cut back their hours, but their pay was not cut. A shorter work week is starting to show up here and there in the United States as well. Kickstarter said a couple of weeks ago it's going to give it a shot. Oftentimes, working less than a five-day, 40-hour week is seen as just another perk for already well-paid white-collar workers. But The results out of Iceland show it can work beyond those traditional office jobs. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
The Iceland trial involved workplaces from childcare centers to hospitals. Alex Pang, author of the book Shorter, Work Better, Smarter, and Less, has studied similar models worldwide in settings as diverse as restaurants, car repair shops, and call centers.
Places where you would not at first imagine that shortening working hours or shortening opening times would be feasible, but it is, and it turns out to have great benefits.
The burger chain Shake Shack, for instance, tried out four-day work weeks for managers in some stores before the pandemic hit. The company reported it boosted recruiting and retention. John Leland, a VP at Kickstarter, who's leading a national campaign for shorter work weeks, says that is a productivity gain.
Less turnover, easier to hire, people don't get burnt out.
The idea that workers would gradually win more leisure time was once common, says Ruth Milkman, a labor sociologist at the City University of New York.
The early U.S. labor movement was all about first a 10-hour day and then an 8-hour day. And at some point, that momentum kind of came to an end.
In part, that's because longer hours are better for companies. Shareholders, not workers, have benefited most from improved productivity over recent decades, says Peter Capelli at the Wharton School.
You know, what do workers gain? It's entirely based on bargaining power.
Which is typically highest for those with specialized skills, like tech workers. But right now, could extend to industries where employers are struggling to hire, like restaurants and retail. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Couple of quick things. Number one, if you're up early and need your business and economic news, David Brancaccio is there for you. Although, actually, I think it's Sabri this week. Also, number two, if you miss us on the air somehow, some way, try our podcast, would you? So there's a couple of things going on in the American labor market right now. More than a couple of things, actually. But look, it's only a half-hour show, right? Two of the big things are that businesses need people to get back to work and back to work quickly. But at the same time, a lot of those people are taking advantage of the moment to get better paying and more satisfying jobs. Jobs that often require a different or maybe a higher skill set, and they might not have the time or the money for a 2 to 4 year degree. One solution might be more short-term training programs, things like certifications or online boot camps. From KPCC in Los Angeles, Jill Replogle looked into that.
Ella Moshtag moved to L.A. from Iran in 2014 with a degree in materials engineering and 15 years of work experience.
I sent my resumes to many, many companies.
Most of them didn't even respond.
I had only one phone interview, and the interviewer asked me if I had a specific certificate in the field of project management.
She didn't. So she thought, I'll do some training courses to beef up my resume. She took an online marketing course, a home improvement sales course. She got a web designing certificate.
I was desperate to find a job, any job.
In total, she spent about $1,500 and still couldn't find work. Moshtag says she was exhausted and confused. Confused because she was faced with hundreds of thousands of different types of short-term training programs to choose from. They range from a few days to a year. There are certificate programs offered through community colleges, boot camps in cybersecurity and web development, digital badges from companies like IBM and Google.
Oh my gosh, it's the wild, wild west.
Su Jin Jez is executive director of California Competes, which does education and workforce policy research.
It's incredibly difficult to navigate. There's no single source of good information.
The payoff of short-term credentials varies a lot. The think tank New America recently analyzed data on short-term training programs in Washington state and found that, on average, trainees got jobs that paid more than the minimum wage, but not enough to support a family. Other research has shown that most short-term credentials lead to a much smaller earnings bump than an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. And Black and Latinx workers are overrepresented in these short-term programs. Still, short-term training can help people get their foot in the door or earn money while they further their education. Hedy Nam heads up workforce development for the nonprofit education group Unite LA.
The value of a short-term credential is that it's much more economically feasible for students, regardless of age and background.
That's important, Nam says, because in today's rapidly changing economy, people of all ages and stages in their career need frequent training to stay relevant. But they should be able to stack that training into an ever more successful career.
So that you have a seamless pathway if you want to pursue learning over the course of your life and increase your income.
Right now, only some short-term credentials offer that pathway, and it's hard to figure out which ones are dead ends and which are roads to success.
Wouldn't it be great if there was like a Google Maps for your career where you say, I'm here and I want to go here. And you could be like, here's an alternate pathway. Here's another alternate pathway.
Nam is actually working with a nonprofit called Credential Engine on the back end of what could eventually become this career app. They're collecting information on short and long-term credentials in order to build an open source data registry. Then, ideally, app developers come in and build something that people like Ella Moshtag could use to navigate their options. Moshtag eventually figured out that what she really needed was a U.S. high school diploma. She earned one and then got a job at T-Mobile. Got promoted, and the company helped pay for her to do a master's program in business administration.
I'm so happy that I accomplished this.
But without good guidance early on, she says, her route to a new career was much longer and curvier than she had hoped. In Los Angeles, I'm Jill Replogle for Marketplace.
So here's a story sort of related to what Megan McCarty-Carino was talking about a minute ago, shorter work weeks. We did a story last week about burnout, which, of course, has gotten worse for a lot of people the past year and a half. And that's at least part of the reason why companies like Bumble and LinkedIn, to name just a couple, are taking an entire week off to force people to get some R&R. Dealing with burnout, though, can be a little bit different when you are the one calling the shots. And that tees up this installment of our series, My Economy. Patty Delgado runs a retail business that is mostly online out of downtown Los Angeles.
I've had a really tough 2021. If I could swear, I would say the swear version of poop. I've been feeling really burnt out, and I think the effects of the pandemic have like finally caught up to me. I think the pandemic and really invited me to just go all into my business. And I think I started realizing just how, you know, making time for myself was so hard, and that started to feel like not normal anymore. Like, you know, me taking a day off or like me wanting to go home and rest just like didn't seem like a good option, or an option that felt risky. Probably also part of the unhealthy relationship with work is, you know, really defining myself through the success of my company. And I'm not my business, you know, like I'm still a good person if I have a bad sales day. This is the first year where I actually pay myself something reasonable. I definitely operated from the scarcity mindset of like, you know, the business deserves this money more than I do, which now in hindsight, that just feels so backwards. My relationship with all the aspects of the business have changed, you know. I love the flexibility of e-commerce, but I really want to bring this more offline. And if that means temporary pop-ups or maybe eventually one flagship brick and mortar, I would love that. We're planning a pop-up tour, and our first pop-up is going to be here at our warehouse this summer. We have a very short window of time to get it done, but it's happening, and I'm really looking forward to like hugging people again and just talking to our customers IRL.
That was Patty Delgado right here in Los Angeles. You know, this series that we do, My Economy, it only works with your help. So please let us know how your economy is doing, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, in which the Ever Given is finally almost free. That big cargo ship that got stuck sideways in the Suez Canal back in March has been impounded by the Egyptian government ever since. Cairo was demanding, ultimately, about $550 million in fees and fines. Seems there is a deal. No dollar amount disclosed. Sadly, the ship is set to be released tomorrow. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context, a bookend of sorts to where we started. The national average for a gallon of gas at $3.13 a gallon, according to AAA. I made a little joke as we started that OPEC says we ought to get used to that. Yeah, well, it's not just OPEC. AAA said today it figures that average goes up another 10 to 20 cents by the end of next month. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, and Janet Wynn. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.